Mr. Speaker, I rise to move the amendment, standing in the name of myself and my right honourable friends. And I start by joining the Prime Minister in expressing revulsion at the killing of hundreds of innocent civilians in Ghouta on the 21st of August. There was a moral outrage. This was a moral outrage, and the international community is right to condemn it. As the Prime Minister said, everyone in this House and most people in the country will have seen the pictures of men, women and children gasping for breath and dying as a result of this heinous attack. I can assure members of this House that the divide that exists does not exist over the condemnation of the use of chemical weapons and the fact that it breaches international law, nor does it lie in the willingness to condemn the regime of President Assad. The question facing this House is what, if any, military action we should take and what criteria should determine that decision. And that's what I want to focus on in my speech today. And I think it's right to say at the beginning of my remarks that the Prime Minister said a couple of times in his speech words to the effect of, we're not going to get further involved in that conflict. This doesn't change our stance on Syria. Now, I've got to say to the Prime Minister, with the greatest respect, that that's simply not the case. For me, that does not rule out military intervention. I want to be clear about this. But I don't think anybody in this House or anybody in the country should be under any illusions about the effect of our relationship to the conflict in Syria if we were to militarily intervene. Now, as I say and as I'll develop in my remarks, that does not, for me, rule out intervention. But I think we need to be clear-eyed. We need to be clear-eyed about the impact that this would have. Let me also say, Mr. Speaker, that this is one of the most solemn duties that this House possesses. And in our minds should be this simple question, which is upholding international law and legitimacy. How can we make the lives of the Syrian people better? And we should also have in our minds, it's right to remember it on this occasion, the duty we owe to the exceptional men and women of our armed forces and their families who will face the direct consequences of any decision that we make. Now, Mr. Speaker, the basis on which we make this decision is of fundamental importance, because the basis of making the decision determines the legitimacy and moral authority of any action that we undertake. That's why our amendment asks the House to support a clear and legitimate roadmap to decision on this issue. A set of steps which enable us to judge any recommended international action. And I want to develop the argument about why this sequential roadmap is, I believe, the right thing for the House to support today. Most of all, if we follow this roadmap, it can assure the country and the international community that if we take action, we will have followed the right, legitimate and legal course, not an artificial timetable or a political timetable set elsewhere. And I think that is very, very important to any decision that we make. Mr. Speaker, this is fundamental to the principles of Britain, a belief in the rule of law, a belief that any military action we take must be justified in terms of the cause and also the potential consequences, and that we strain every sinew to make the international institutions that we have in our world work to deal with the outrages in Syria. Let me turn to the conditions in our motion. First, and this is where the Prime Minister and I now agree, we must let the UN weapons inspectors do their work and let them report to the Security Council. Ban Ki-moon, the UN Secretary General, said yesterday about the weapons inspectors, and I quote, "Let them conclude their work for 4 days, and then we will have to analyse scientifically with experts, and then we will have to report to the Security Council for action." So the weapons inspectors are in the midst of their work and will be reporting in the coming days. That is why today could not have been the day when the House was asked to decide on military action. For this House, it is surely a basic point. Evidence should precede decision, not decision precede evidence. And I am glad that on reflection the Prime Minister accepted this yesterday. Now it is true, because some people will raise this issue, the weapons inspectors cannot reach a judgment on the attribution of blame. That is beyond their mandate. Now, some might think that that makes their work essentially irrelevant. I disagree. If the UN weapons inspectors conclude that chemical weapons have been used, in the eyes of this country and the world, that confers legitimacy on the finding beyond the view of any individual country or any intelligence agency. What is more, it is possible that what the weapons inspectors discover could give the world greater confidence in identifying the perpetrators of this horrific attack. The second step, Mr. Speaker, in our roadmap makes clear there needs to be compelling evidence that the Syrian regime was responsible for the attacks. I welcome the letter from the chairman of the Joint Intelligence Committee today, and I note the Arab League's view of President Assad's culpability. Of course, as the Prime Minister said, in conflict there is always reason for doubt, but the greater the weight of evidence, the better. On Tuesday, we were promised there will be the release of American intelligence that there was proof of the regime culpability. We await the publication of that evidence, which I'll be gathered will be later today, but that evidence too will be important in building up the body of evidence that President Assad was responsible. I will.
I'm very grateful to the Leader of the Opposition. He has said that he might be able to support military action of the kind that the government is contemplating. He has put in his amendment a list of requirements, virtually all of which, so far as I can tell, appear in the government's own motion. Why can he not, therefore, support the government's motion in order that this House could speak with a united voice to the world on this day?
I'll develop in my remarks why I don't think that's the case. In particular, I would point to the fact that the government's amendment does not mention compelling evidence against President Assad. And I will develop in my remarks on the fifth point in our amendment, which is very, very important, the basis on which we judge whether action can be justified in terms of the consequences. And I will come to that later in my remarks. The third step, Mr. Speaker, is that in light of the weapons inspector's findings and this other evidence, and as the Secretary-General said, the UN Security Council should then debate what action should be taken and indeed should vote on action. Mr. Speaker, I've heard it suggested that we should have a United Nations moment. They're certainly not my words. They are words which do no justice to the seriousness with which we must take the United Nations. The UN is not some inconvenient sideshow, and we don't want to engineer a moment. Instead, we want to adhere to the principles of international law. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
I very much welcome his doctrine that evidence should precede decision. That's a stark change from at least one of his predecessors. Can he tell the House whether he believes that the evidence which has been presented to us today by the Joint Intelligence Committee is compelling or not?
I think this is important evidence, but I think we need to gather further evidence over the coming days. That is part of persuading the international community and people in this country of President Assad's culpability, and I think that's important. Now let me just come to his earlier point, though. Let me come to his earlier point, because the Prime Minister raised it too. I'm very clear about the fact that we've got to learn the lessons of Iraq. Of course we've got to learn those lessons. And one of the most important lessons was indeed about respect for the United Nations, and that is part of our amendment today. Now let me just say on the question of the Security Council, Mr. Speaker, I'm also clear it is incumbent on us to try to build the widest level of support among the 15 members of the Security Council, whatever the intentions of particular countries. The level of international support is vital should we decide to take military action. It is vital in the eyes of the world. That's why it can't be seen as some sideshow or some moment, but actually an essential part of building the case if intervention takes place. I give way.
I thank the Leader of the Opposition for giving way. And he is right, the UN Security Council should not be just a slideshow. But why does his motion merely say that the Security Council should have voted on the matter rather than it should have voted in favour of some intervention?
I'll come directly to that question. Because there will be those who argue that in the event of Russia and China vetoing a Security Council resolution, that any military action would necessarily not be legitimate. I understand that view, but I don't agree with it. Because I believe that if there is a proper case made, then there is scope in international law, our fourth condition, for action to be taken even without a Chapter 7 Security Council resolution. Kosovo in 1999 is the precedent cited in the Prime Minister's speech and in the Attorney General's legal advice. But Mr. Speaker, the Prime Minister didn't go in much detail of the Attorney General's legal advice. Because it's worth noting that in the Attorney General's legal advice, there are three very important conditions. convincing evidence, generally accepted by the international community as a whole, of extreme humanitarian distress. Second, objectively clear, there is no practical alternative to the use of force if lives are to be saved. That is a testing condition which we need to test out in the coming days and the coming period. And third, the proposed use of force must be proportionate and strictly limited in time. So the attorney concludes in his advice, it's very, very important for the House to understand this, that there could be circumstances in the absence of a Chapter 7 Security Council resolution for action to be taken, but subject to those three conditions. And that is the case that must be built over the coming period. Now, these principles, Mr. Speaker, reflect the responsibility to protect, a doctrine developed since Kosovo, which commands widespread support.
I just thought, I mean, he's right, I didn't cover everything in my speech. I could have gone into more detail on the Attorney-General's advice. But I just thought, for the clarity of the House, those who might not have time to read it, the Leader of the Opposition mentioned the three conditions. The very next sentence from the Attorney-General's advice is, all three conditions would clearly be met in this case.
Well, that is the Attorney-General's view, and that is the view that needs to be tested. And that's the view that... No, but that is the view that needs to be tested out. That is the view that needs to be tested out over the coming period. Of course that is a case, and that is a judgment that will have to be made. But additionally, Mr. Speaker, the responsibility to protect also demands a reasonable prospect of success in improving the plight of the Syrian people. Now, the responsibility to protect is an essential part of making this case. This takes me, Mr. Speaker, to the final point of the roadmap we propose. Any military action...
I'm referring to the fourth paragraph of our roadmap, and he has already touched on any action must be legal, proportionate and time-limited, and then goes on to say have precise and achievable objectives. Could he detail what those objectives are?
Well, that is, I'm coming exactly to that point, which is that the government needs to set that out in the coming days. And that takes me precisely to the final point of the roadmap, which is any military action must be specifically designed to deter the future use of chemical weapons. It must be time-limited with specific purpose and scope, so that future action would require further recourse to this House. And it must have regard to the consequences of any action. Now Mr. Speaker, we must ensure... That every effort is made to bring the civil war in Syria to an end, and the principal responsibility for that, of course, rests with the parties in that conflict, and in particular President Assad. But the international community, I'm just going to make a bit more progress, but the international community also has a duty to do everything it can to support the Geneva II process, and any action, and this is the key point we take, must assist this process and not hinder it. And that is the responsibility that lies on the government in the coming period, the government and its allies, to set out that case. Now, there'll be some in this House who say that Britain should not contemplate action, even when it is limited, because we do not know precisely the consequences that will follow. I'm not, as I said, with those who rule out action. The horrific events unfolding in Syria do ask us to consider all the options available. But here is the point, Mr. Speaker. I just want to make a bit more progress. We owe it to the Syrian people, to our own country, and to the future security of our world to scrutinise any plans on the basis of the consequences that they have. And by setting the framework today, we give ourselves the time and space to actually scrutinise what is being proposed by the government to see what the implications are. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
Just for the sake of clarity for the House, can the Right Honourable Gentleman tell us, if there was no UN security resolution, would the Labour opposition back military intervention?
It depends on the case that has been set out and the extent to which an international support has been developed. And look, the Honourable Gentleman opposite are making strange noises. Look, I've got to say to them, it is right to go about this process in a calm and measured way. If people are asking me today to say, yes, now let us take military action, I'm not going to say that. But nor am I going to rule out military action, because we have to do so on the basis of evidence and the basis of the consensus and the support that can be built. I give way.
I thank the Leader of the Opposition for giving way. The Honourable Member for Hampton and Kilburn asked a very important question, which I feel he didn't answer fully. In paragraph E of his motion, he refers to precise and achievable objectives. I assume that means that he has in mind precise and achievable objectives. Can he detail what they would be, please?
Yes, I can. Yes, I can, because it goes on to say, designed to deter the future use of prohibited chemical weapons in Syria. So, as it also says in point five, such action must have regard to the potential consequences in the region. So any proposed action to deter the use of chemical weapons must be judged against the consequences that will take place. And I think there is further work on the government necessary to set out what those consequences would be. I give way to the Honourable Gentleman.
On the issue of consequences, I'm listening very carefully to what the Leader of the Opposition is saying. And he's effectively making a very strong case against military action. As the military action envisaged, the consequences of which are very unquantifiable because the objectives are frankly pretty soft in terms of degrading and deterring, and the link between military effect and the actual effect on the ground. And then he's also linked it to the consequences for the Geneva II process, which can only be negative.
I'm saying to the Honourable Gentleman and to the House that we have to assess over the coming period in a calm and measured way, not in a knee-jerk way and not on a political timetable, whether the advantages of potential action, whether it can be done on the basis of legitimacy in international law, and what the consequences would be.
Yeah, I did wait. Thank the Honourable Gentleman for giving way. Listening to this speech, any reasonable human being would assume that the gentleman is looking to divide the House for political advantage. What has happened to the... What has happened? What has happened to the national interest?
I have to say that intervention is not worthy of the Honourable Gentleman. I am merely trying to set out a framework for decision for this House. My interest in this all along has been to ensure that the House of Commons can make this decision when the evidence is available. Now, look, there'll be some people in this House, I will give way in a moment. There'll be some people in this House, Mr. Speaker, who think this decision is simple, and they clearly are on some of the opposition, on the government benches. There'll be some people who think that we can make the decision now that we should engage in military conflict. Equally, there are those who think we should just rule out military conflict now. Now, I happen to think that we've got to assess the evidence over the coming period, and I think that is the right thing to do. And our roadmap... And our roadmap sets out how we would do it. I give way to my Honourable friend.
It's one thing to not rule out military action, but isn't the problem with the government's motion that it's an in-principle vote for military action now, before we hear what the inspectors say and before the UN processes take place?
Yeah. I say to my Honourable friend and to the House that it was noticeable this morning that it was certainly being presented, the government motion, as the, if it was voted for, and I think this is an important point, as the House endorsing the principle of military action. That is why I don't feel ready to support the government motion. That is why I think our motion, which sets out a framework for decision, is the right thing to do. I'm going to make a bit more progress. I will give way, yeah.
Will the Right Honourable Gentleman confirm that in advance of previous conflicts, such as the intervention in Afghanistan, political parties in this House were briefed in detail and on Privy Council terms on the nature of the evidence of why there should be intervention? Can he confirm that there have been no such briefings in advance of this vote?
Well, actually, Mr. Speaker, I have had the benefit of briefings with the Prime Minister. But I'm sure the Prime Minister, having heard his intervention, will want to extend that facility to him and to other minority parties. So Mr. Speaker, as I was saying, I won't give way. By setting this framework today, we give ourselves the time and space to assess the impact this would have on the Syrian people, any intervention, and indeed the framework of international law and legitimacy. And as I said, I do not believe we should be rushed to judgment on this question on a political timetable set elsewhere. In the coming days, the government has a responsibility, building on what the Prime Minister did today, but more than what he did today, to set out its case for why the benefits of intervention and action outweigh the benefits of not acting. Now, I do not rule out supporting the Prime Minister. I just want to make this point. I do not rule out supporting the Prime Minister, but I believe he has to make a better case than he did today on this question. And frankly, he cannot say to the House and to the country, this does not change our stance on Syria, this does not change our involvement in the Syrian conflict, because frankly, it would, Mr. Speaker, and the House will need to assess it. Now, I'm not going to give way. Our amendment sets out a roadmap from evidence to decision that I believe can command the confidence of the House and the British public. And crucially, and this is an important point, it places responsibility for the judgment about the achievement of the criteria for action, reporting by the weapons inspectors, compelling evidence, the vote in the Security Council, the legal base, and the prospect of successful action with this House in a subsequent vote. I hope that the House can unite around our amendment today, because I believe it captures a shared view on all sides of this House, both about our anger at the attack on innocent civilians, but also a coherent framework for making the decision on how we respond.
I will give way, yeah.
Can I thank my honourable friend and indeed the Shadow Foreign Secretary for the measured approach they've taken on this very serious issue? But does she agree with me that any reckless or irresponsible action could lead to full war in that area? And we have to understand from previous conflicts that war is not some sort of hokey-cokey concept. Once you're in, you're in.
That's why there mustn't be a rush to judgment. My honourable friend is entirely right. I give way to the honourable lady.
I thank the right honourable gentleman for giving way. The honourable gentleman speaks of a roadmap. Does he not appreciate that the first stage in our response to these atrocities is what we do in this chamber this afternoon? Given that his perfectly legitimate concerns about consequences, evidence, etc., have been met by the government motion, could I urge him? To support the motion so we can send a united, strong
Absolutely.
Message to
That's
Assad
right.
and others. Otherwise, we will be undermining our own national security.
Yes. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, we're not going to be supporting a government motion which was briefed this morning at setting out an in-principle decision to take military action. That would be the wrong thing to do. And on that basis, we will oppose the motion. We could only support military action and should only make the decision to do so when the conditions of our amendment are met, and if they are met. Now, Mr. Speaker, we all know that stability cannot be achieved by military means alone. I want to end by saying this. The continued turmoil in the country and the region in recent months and years further demonstrate the need to ensure that we uphold the fate of innocent civilians, the national interest and the security and future prosperity of the whole region and the world. I know the whole House recognises that this will not and cannot be achieved through a military solution. Whatever our disagreements today, we on this side of the House stand ready to play our part in supporting measures to improve the prospect for peace in Syria and the Middle East. It is what the people of Britain and the world have the right to expect. But this, Mr. Speaker, is a very grave decision, and it should be treated as such by this House, and it will be treated as such by this country. In the end, the fundamental test will be this. As we think about the men, women and children who have been subjected to this atrocity, and we think about the prospects for other citizens in Syria, can the international community act in a lawful and legitimate way that will help them and prevent further suffering? The seriousness of our deliberations should match the significance of the decision we face. That is why I urge the House to support our amendment today.
Order the question.